We had gotten down to the ninth verse, and I want you to note, if you have a pen, I'd say it'd probably be a wise thing to do, and just underline that little word, cut off, from here to the end of this chapter. You'll be astonished at the number of times you have the word cut off. There are times that I notice things like that and try to put some stress upon them. But one of the cutoffs was back up there in verse 9. But our lesson tonight will start at verse 10. And in verse 10 and 11, the prophet Micah tells us that in the Messiah's kingdom, Israel's instruments of war will disappear. They will disappear for the simple reason they will not be needed, because nation will not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So that's going to be the reason why they'll not be there. Now the prophet will describe all these weapons of warfare in the terms common in his day. And in other words, he's not going to say jeeps and tanks and jet planes and battleships. You understand what I mean when I say it like that? He describes things as they existed in his day. Somebody, well, now, if he was talking about the end time, is talking about our day and time, why didn't he say battleships and aircraft carriers and various planes and tanks and guns and all of that? Well, let's just suppose that he had written all that down there. Who in the world in that day and time would have known what he was talking about? As a matter of fact, who would have known what he was talking about for about 1,500 years or more? Nobody. So then it wouldn't have made a lick of sense to anybody. The Bible would have been a very foolish and stupid book, and nobody could have got any sense out of it. So the only thing that the prophet could do was to speak in terms that made sense in his day. In his day, if you went out to war, you had horses and chariots. That's what was used in battle. And so he uses the terminology here just exactly like existed in his day and all of that. Now let's read the 10th verse there where the horses and the chariots are to be destroyed. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that I will cut off thy horses out of the midst of thee, and I will destroy thy chariots. Before we come in on that, I want to show you another example of this same period of time. Go to the book of Zechariah we studied some time back and look at verse 10 of the 9th chapter. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he will speak peace unto the heathen. And his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. And so essentially we have the same thing stated there in Micah that is stated in the book of Zechariah. And so the two of them compare. Even the word cut off occurs in both of the accounts that I've read there. So I say again now that Micah has described military weaponry in the only way that he knew. And his language had to be understandable to the people during the day in which he lived. Somebody said, well, then that makes all the prophecy that he uttered obsolete in this modern day and time. No, it doesn't make it obsolete at all. His predictions were not annulled by the weapons of his day becoming obsolete. He described what he could in the way that he could. And it may be tanks and battleships and aircraft carriers and jets and the like in the final scene, but he described it in the only way that he could. Ezekiel did the same thing, I believe, in the 38th chapter, where he described a great battle there too. And so to me, that's not uncommon. Horses and chariots were very important. And one of the problems that Israel seemed to have, according to the Bible, was that instead of trusting in the Lord, they sometimes trusted in their horses and in their chariots. Look at one of the verses there in Psalms 20 in verse 7. Some trust in chariots and some in horses. Now, I guess if we were to put that down in a contemporary scene, we'd say some trust in the atomic bomb and some trust in the cobalt bomb. Or we might say some trust the American Air Force. or some trust the American Navy. Why? Because people often will trust in military weapons instead of God. And that's the problem that Israel had. They were trusting in horses. They were trusting in chariots. And they were not trusting in the Lord. So the Lord is going to take away their arm of the flesh in the millennium. He's going to take it away for one reason, because they won't have it there to trust in. They can only trust in the Lord. So horses and chariots had been that Israel had trusted in at times, but it would be removed by Jehovah. So Israel could no longer lean on the arm of the flesh. The shepherd of Israel would be her great protector. And so all human aids would be taken away. I sometimes wonder if there's not a spiritual lesson in that verse. You know, we're so inclined sometimes to trust in men or women, to trust in certain things that we have, that maybe we have made or others have made. And maybe sometime we trust in them instead of the Lord. And in some cases the Lord takes them away. So my point is that we had better not trust in fleshly things, because God can remove them. As the language of Micah is, cut them off. That means exterminate them for good. So the great lesson in that verse from the practical standpoint is always trust in the Lord and lean not to your own understanding. Let the Lord be your hope. Let the Lord be your confidence and nothing else. So really there's some lessons here in faith, though the word itself is not mentioned. Nevertheless, there's a lesson there. Now let's go to that 11th verse where the cities and the fortresses are going to be removed also. Or as the prophet says, cut off. And I will cut off the cities of thy land and throw down all thy strongholds. Do you know what cities mostly were back in the Old Testament time? They were abodes of luxury and pride. And you know that a lot of people today will boast about and say, well, I live in New York City, you know, and I live in Chicago, or I live in Tupelo, Mississippi, or I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and on I could go, as if it's a special blessing to live in some large city. Well, I'm pretty much of a country boy, and I never have denied that, but I would say that most of the large cities that I've been to, I wouldn't want to live in. There are places in some of them that it's not even safe to walk down the streets in broad open daylight, let alone at night. And one old man said, in one of those large cities when I was staying in his home, and he was in the city of Detroit, he said, you'd be safer in the African jungles with all of the ferocious animals of the wilderness than you would be walking down the streets of Detroit in certain parts of the town at night. And I guess he knew what he was talking about. He'd lived there all of his life, worked in a large automotive plant of some kind, if I remember. So he's going to take away the cities. And I don't believe that he means by that he's going to completely destroy all cities, because you're going to have the new Jerusalem in the eternal state, and you're going to have cities like Jerusalem even in the millennial state. But what it is, these cities that were monuments of pride, if I have to put it this way, these great Babylons that men have built, they will be taken down. Maybe there won't be any New York City or Paris or France. Paris, France, and all these cities. Now you say, well, why would you say that? Well, what about a statement over here in the book of Revelation? I thought of it this afternoon as I was preparing this lesson. It talks about the great granddaddy earthquake coming just before Christ comes back. Zechariah 14 talks about that earthquake. But anyway, it mentions how there'll be a great earthquake, and there's never been anything like it, never so mighty an earthquake and so great. And it said the great city that was And the great city was divided in three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. There went New York City. So much for Washington, D.C. So much for Moscow and London and all the other places. Berlin, Peking. They're all gone. Tokyo. They're all gone. So whenever the Lord says over there that he's going to cut off the cities, I assume that a great many of them will be cut off. They'll be destroyed in connection with that great granddaddy earthquake that will take place when the feet of Christ touch the Mount of Olives when he comes back at his second advent to engage in the Battle of Armageddon. So when it says, I will cut off the cities of thy land and throw down all of thy strongholds, what he's doing there is taking away all of the military defense. There's nothing going to be left of it. So they won't be able to trust in their swords and spears or their tanks or guns, whichever way you want to think of it, in their day or our day. He's going to take away all of these things of military might that people like to put their faith in instead of God. So in the millennium, the only one you can trust in is the Lord. Now this morning here in Sunday school, I read Psalms 2. And that's all about the millennium in the main. About how there'll be the revolt of the nations and then the king comes back. But you know that it stresses in the latter part of that, blessed are all of they that trust in him. There won't be anything else to trust in, is what I'm pointing out. It's all going to be cut off or removed. So these cities of pride, they're going to be cut off. The kingdom of Christ will not be characterized by a lot of pomp and vain glory. He's going to shut it all out, you see. And so all man-made defenses are removed. And really this is all in harmony with the fact that nation will not learn war anymore, that there will be peace on earth and goodwill among men. You won't need any of these things because it will be a peaceful kingdom, you see. There won't be any wars and rumors of wars. Then we come down to the next section here, which goes from about verse 12 to 14, and it tells us that all idolatrous worship will be removed out of the land. You can read the history of Israel all the way back from the time that they came out of Egypt until the very time of our Lord Jesus Christ, and they always had a problem with idols. They always had a problem with idol worship. Now, God condemned it time after time, and they executed people for engaging in this idolatrous worship, but they still never got rid of it. It clung to them like miry clay to the feet. They couldn't seem to get rid of it. But there is one that's going to abolish it out of the land. King Saul didn't succeed in doing that. Though he did try, we'll give him credit for what he did do. Give him E for effort. He did try, but there was a few witches and necromancers and others left when he got through with his cleansing work. Because he went to one of them at Endor before the thing was over with. But in verse 12, we see that witchcraft and soothsayers are going to be cut off. And I will cut off witchcraft out of thine hand. And if I understand that, it's not only the black arts, but it's the witches as well will be cut off. I mean, if you do away with the practice, you've got to do away with the people that practice it. I mean, it has to go hand in hand. Unless you're going to convert them all, and they're all going to be saved, and then they'll do away with it another way. But when he uses that word cut off, that's a word of judgment. That's not a word about a man being saved. That's about a man being exterminated. Actually, in Israel, it was used in connection with the death penalty for a capital offense. If a man was cut off, they killed him. So I will cut off witches out of thine hand, as if they'd held them in their hand, you know, something to trust in, something to believe in. I say that the word faith is not mentioned here, but it's behind the scene. And thou shalt have no more soothsayers. So it's all going to be over and done with. Have you ever thought about the awful condemnation that God gives in the Bible against witchcraft? Let me just read you a verse or two here. Look in Exodus 22 and 18. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. A lot of people think about the Salem trials here in the United States and how that they had the ducking ponds and they burned people at a stake and sometimes probably put a rope around their neck and all kinds of things happened to them. People said, well, that was a terrible thing. Well, in fact, they were probably just carrying out the law of the Bible. Now, maybe they did get overly zealous and burn a few people that ought not to have been burned and hang a few people that ought not to have been hanged. But I'm not so sure that they were wrong in the basic idea that they had. Because the Bible said, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And King Saul tried to kill them all. And really he had scripture for it. He really did. Over there in Galatians of the New Testament, chapter 5, verse 19 and 20, it talks about witchcraft. Talks about the 21 sins of the flesh and mentions that as one and says, they that do such shall not inherit the kingdom of God. So you can't be a witch and be a Christian. It's incompatible. In other words, you can't serve God and the devil at the same time. You can't serve mammon and God. You can't be a partaker of the Lord's table and the table of devils. It's just not possible to be that way. So they have work spells and charms. And we still have witches today. Just turn the TV on sometimes. You say, well, it's all in movies. No, there's an organization of witches all over the world. Out in California, they're out there as thick as custard pies, the old man said. And they're in England, they're in London, and they have the Black Mass, and they have all kinds of things going on throughout the world. And when I lived in the state of Kentucky, there was a preacher that had a son, a friend of mine, and his wife, this young boy's wife, got involved in witchcraft, and they took their daughter, unknowing to the boy, they divorced over this, incidentally. I don't know. I never know whether that's ground or not, but I'd be pretty upset about it. I'll say that. I don't know just how I'd react to something like that. Anyway, the young girl took their little girl and had her wound pierced in a ceremony. And, of course, they divorced over it. I don't know. I think I might have killed her. They probably had to try me for murder. I know that it'd be wrong, but I'm telling you, that would really have upset me to no end, and it certainly did this young boy. And I'm really talking about Brother Robert Patton's son, in case some of you don't know. That's the boy that it happened to, and he came over and talked to me about it at great length. So when you talk about witches, you're not talking about something that existed in the Dark Ages or something that existed over in Europe in the 1800s or in America in the 1700s and 1600s. You're talking about things that exist right now, tonight, and you cannot get a lot of information sometime about them because they don't go around and publish a lot. But more and more they're getting in the news, and more people are joining in witch ceremonies. And I've heard things the last few years that have literally shocked me. So whenever he talks about cutting witches off out of the land, believe me, in the end time there will be plenty of witches in the world. There's already plenty of them tonight. Now, soothsayers, what's that? Well, I did a little study on the word because I've always wondered myself what that meant. I knew the basic idea, but it means, in the Hebrew, sign monger. And what it was, they were diviners by the clouds. They'd go out and look at the color or the shape of the cloud, and they would make a prediction based on that. I think today we have another name for them. We call them rainmakers. But it's the same fellows that were back over there in the Old Testament that were called soothsayers. We just call them rainmakers. Now, what is so wrong with sorcery? Somebody said, can you actually get information about the hereafter? Can you actually learn things that you couldn't learn any other way by supernatural means, by means of the black arts? Yes. Ooh, preacher, that's quite a statement. I said yes. But it is a forbidden way of learning about the future. We are not to learn about the future from a crystal ball or a fortune teller or some sorcerer. We are to learn about the future from God and the writings of the prophets. And I couldn't stress that too much. Well, I don't want to be too long-winded tonight, especially after we sang so long, but I want to take a little time here. Go over there to the book of Deuteronomy, the 18th chapter. We just need to get some of this clear in mind here. I want to just spend a little time looking at some verses here. Start about the 9th verse. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abomination of those nations, especially the black arts. And then he starts listing. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, Moloch worship, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord. Now that's what God thinks about him, spelled out in plain language. And because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. So sorcery, witchcraft, you call it what you want to, will destroy a nation. Look at that. It destroyed the Canaanites. That's why Israel got their land. That's what the Bible said. Thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. That means upright or sincere. For these nations which thou shalt possess hearkened unto observers of times and unto diviners, but as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee to do so. So God's people had no business fooling around with the black arts. They're the devil. Now he tells them about how that he's going to send Christ, the great prophet. He's supposed to listen to him, not to fortune tellers and wizards and the like. The Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee, of thy brethren, like unto me. Unto him ye shall hearken. Listen to Christ, the great prophet. Not Gene Dixon. Not Nostradamus or some of the others. According to all that thou desirest of the Lord thy God in Horeb, in the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord thy God, neither let me see this great fire any more, that I die not. And the Lord said unto me, they have well spoken that which they have spoken. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I command him. We are to observe all things that he commanded us. Think of that verse there in Matthew 28. This is Christ in verse 18. It was Christ in verse 15. Like Moses, he was a prophet. Moses was a prophet. Christ was a prophet. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. You'd better listen to Christ, the great prophet. If you don't know the future, go to him. So what about these false prophets? Look at verse 20. But the prophet which shall presume to speak a word in my name, false prophet, which I have not commanded him to speak, or that shall speak in the name of other gods, even that prophet shall die. If the people don't kill him, God will. And if thou say in thine heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord hath not spoken? How do we know what the devil said and what God said? When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not, nor come to pass, that he has spoken which the Lord hath not spoken, but the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously, thou shalt not be afraid of him. Think about all these fellows predicting the second advent of Christ that lied about it. You remember Rosh Hanukkah? The old boy had the Lord coming in September, and then he didn't come, and then he said he'd going to come later, and he still didn't come, and finally admitted he just absolutely was wrong about it. Well, he should have told us that to start with. You see, the words of the prophet didn't come to pass, so what? He was a false prophet. Probably an unsaved man. I think he was probably a great man in the field of science, but I don't think he knew much about the Scriptures. If he did, he'd been very careful about uttering a prophecy like that. So even the paraphernalia of the occultism, the very presence of its practitioners will be removed by Christ in the millennium. He's going to get rid of them. They won't be here in the kingdom ages. They will, where will all the witches be? They won't be on this earth. They'll be cut off, the Bible said. Who's going to cut them off? Christ is going to cut them off. He's going to judge them in his wrath, and he'll cut them off. And then in verse 13 and 14, we see how that the idol gods will be removed. Thy graven images also will I cut off, and thy standing images out of the midst of thee. And thou shalt no more worship the work of thine hands. When I read that statement there, worshiping the work of thine hands, I always think about people that make idols by their hands, and then they turn around and they bow down before that thing they made with their own hands. I mean, the maker is greater than the idol. Isn't that stupid when you think about it? Suppose I'd sit down and take my pocket knife out and carve out me a pretty little idol. And then I'd bow down before it, you know, and worship that. Wouldn't that be a stupid thing to do? What would I be doing? I'd be worshiping the works of my own hands. In other words, I made my own God. A homemade God, I'd be worshiping that. And really, that's what the heathens do. Well, graven images were usually made out of metal or out of stone, and they were forbidden. And Brother Steve read here this morning, and I think I read last Sunday from Exodus 20:4, how that we're not to make any image or anything like that and fall down before it. And one of the problems was in Israel that they began to do all of those things. And really, they never got off of it, seemed like. Once they got started, they never could get stopped. Look there in 1 Kings 14, in the reign of Jeroboam. And see what they did there in verse 22. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins, which they had committed above all that their fathers had done. For they also built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. Sound like it wasn't any place you go that there wasn't some kind of idol god, the way that describes it. And there were also sodomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. So in the time of the millennial kingdom, the graven images will be demolished. They'll be demolished. Now, graven images were sometimes stone pillars. Looked like a column made out of stone, if I have to put it like that. And that pillar would mark the place where they would worship this idol god. Now, it really wasn't wrong to set up a stone and worship the true God. Jacob did that. He set that stone up, and it was called Bethel, the house of God. I mean, that's where he worshiped God. He went back to that place, and he worshiped God again. And you'll find quite often in the Bible they would set up a stone to mark the place where they would worship God. There's not anything wrong with that. But you see, in later times, That proper worship there degenerated into worshiping the idol instead of God. And that's always what happens. Whenever you set up a man-made God, then you forget about the true God that's the Spirit. And so it started out as a good thing, but it ended up a bad thing. And maybe Jacob did a good thing, but some of them later after him didn't do so well about that. They let that thing degenerate, and it was condemned in no uncertain terms there in the 16th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, verse 21 and 22. And then it said, thy groves, and this is a bit interesting, especially since it brings to me some thoughts about a knowledge about the American Indians and all of that. Maybe this is where they got it. Thy groves, really there in the Hebrew, is, well, the Ashtaroth pole would be about the way that I would put it out so you could understand it. That was a Canaanite goddess, female god. Now she corresponds to Ashtaroth, and that's what she was called by the Phoenicians. Ishtar, as she was called by the Assyrians. And her symbol was a tree or a wooden post. And I'd really like to go into that quite a bit, but don't have time. She was sometimes known as the wife or the sister of the god El. She later became connected with Baal in later times in Israel. So Ashtaroth, Baal, Ishtar, all of these are really the one same female goddess. There's a lot I could say about it, but I don't have time to go into that. But anyway, Baal worship, all of that's a chip off of the same block. And so this idolatry is going to be abolished. It was an idolatry that plagued Israel for centuries. And I'm not sure that some modern forms of it do not plague the modern world today. And I might go into that at a later time sometime. In case you don't think there's any of it that plagues the modern world, Now remember that her symbol was a tree or a wooden post. Well, go home tonight and read the 10th chapter of Jeremiah, the first 10 verses, and see if you can find anybody today that does like they did back there in the time when they worshipped Ashtaroth and all of that. See if you can find Ishtar worship in today. You just go over there and read it. I don't ask you to do anything but just read it. Just read the 10th chapter of Jeremiah, and then you make your own decision about it after you read what the Bible said there on the subject. Then he goes on to say, I will pluck up thy groves out of the midst of thee, so will I destroy thy cities. These cities, again, were cities of Babylon. They were cities of idol worship. All the cities that have worshipped idols will be destroyed. Christ will remove all forms of idolatry from his kingdom. Somebody might say, well, now, the kingdom that he described here in this chapter is the gospel church. Well, then why are not all the witches and all the idols been abolished out of the land if we're now in the kingdom that Micah talks about? Maybe our friends on the other side would like to explain that. I'd like to propose that they answer that question. If in the kingdom of Christ it's going to be cut off out of the land, there's not going to be any witches or wizards, not any soothsayers and necromancers, then why do we have them today if we're in the kingdom of Christ that Micah spoke of? I think that is almost unanswerable, unless you admit that you're wrong about your amillennialism. And then you could get a lot of things straightened out. But I don't believe they can answer that, because we still have these things, and yet they say we're in the kingdom of Christ. The Bible said they'll be cut off out of the land, but they're in the land, see. So we can't be living in the kingdom that Micah speaks of. We will one day, but we're not now. It's a future kingdom, you see. Well, quickly look at verse 15. God's judgment on the unbelieving Gentiles, and I will execute vengeance in anger and fear upon the heathen such as they have not heard. There will not only be unparalleled suffering in the tribulation, there will be unparalleled suffering by those enemies of Christ when he comes back at the battle of Armageddon. The world's never heard of the destruction that he's going to mete out to them. Well, this same event here is predicted in many other scriptures in the Bible, which I certainly do not have time to read here tonight. Joel 3, 1 to 16. Zechariah 12, 1 to 6. Zechariah 14, 1 and 3. Matthew 25, 31 to 46. Revelation 16, 16 to 21. Revelation 19, 11 to 21. And there are others. But all those passages describe Christ coming back and fighting for Israel and destroying the armies of Antichrist. That is the same thing that Micah is speaking about here in that verse. And so I would say that 15th verse there is describing the Battle of Armageddon. I mean, just put it simple, that's what it's doing. And what we see in that description of the Battle of Armageddon is the irresistible certainty of the Lord's defense of his own sovereignty. He will defend his sovereignty. Men may deny it, but they won't deny it at the Battle of Armageddon, when he makes war upon the enemies of his kingdom. Well, that's our lesson for tonight. I trust you may have gotten something out of it. Be sure to read in that 6th chapter and see what you can find out about that before we study it, the Lord willing, next Sunday night. Let us stand and we shall sing.